Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Now let's get to a little bit more in terms of the fundamentals that is really all about the stock that everyone is talking about.
Yeah, it is NVIDIA, of course. And with us, we got Bloomberg News U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter Ian King joining us from San Francisco, along with Bloomberg Intelligence senior tech industry analyst Kunjan Sabhani, both in our in San Francisco, Kunjan in our Bloomberg Bureau. Hey, Ian, I want to start with you because when the earnings crossed yesterday just after 4 o'clock, there was a little bit of uncertainty when this release came out. We saw the stock jump around, even go into the red for a few minutes. What was it that firmly cemented in investors' minds that this was another blockbuster report for NVIDIA, because they weren't convinced right when these numbers came out?
I mean, I think the best way to answer that is I just spoke with a fund manager on this very topic, and what he said was, ignore all of the stuff that Abigail has just beautifully told you about and explained all of these multiples and numbers doesn't mean anything. What NVIDIA did was firm up in everybody's mind, this is real and this is going to continue. And as soon as that became clear, as soon as they started talking and Jensen Huang, the CEO, had answers for a number of the lingering concerns that were out there, we're off to the races and the rally was back on.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable because we really did bounce around. Kunjan, come on in. As you've gone through the release, had time to digest what we got from NVIDIA. What to you is so remarkable about the results and the outlook in your view?
I think it's similar in what lines to what Ian said. It was not the magnitude of the beat that was sort of expected. It was the quality of the report, especially the sustainability of the demand. Look, demand didn't just increase from the large cloud players, which we expected. Demand is strong from enterprises. Demand is strong from new avenues like new verticals, automotive, healthcare. Demand is strong from the hyperscalers. And now you have these sovereign entities coming in also buying. So the broad-based demand and the health of it and the sustainability, what was really drove the investor confidence.
Hey, Ian, you know where I'm going with this, because I ask you this every quarter, every few months, and it's about the basics of economics here. When there is something attractive in the business world, you have a lot of companies run after it. And I'm wondering about NVIDIA's moat here. To what extent do they have a moat, and is it established around what it does for AI in the AI world? And to what extent are competitors able to actually catch up here?
Yeah, two things to answer that. I think overall growth is going to lift all boats for if the projections that we've seen from people like Jensen and people like Lisa Su at AMD are true. Everybody's going up in the short term on this, so we don't need to worry about the competitive dynamics. Long term, there are clearly companies who are looking at NVIDIA selling chips multiple tens of thousands of dollars and saying, I want some of that action, and they're going after it. But this is something that NVIDIA have been working on for several years, and guess what? They're going to have a new architecture, a new chip coming this year, and guess what? The rate at which they're introducing new technology is increasing. So not only are they anticipating competition, but they're doing something about it already.
Well, and I want to kind of get into that. First of all, I want to show a chart for those who are watching on TV and on YouTube and on our streaming service. But the NVIDIA data center revenue, I mean, the chart, it's just astronomical in terms of how much it has taken off just from last year. It's like mind blowing. And I do wonder, Ian, let me go this to you first. I mean, the question is, you know, how long can they continue at this pace in the face of growing competition?
I mean, again, I can just point you to the explanation that I got from somebody who's put the money to work in this stock. And they said what's exciting them is the fact that so many sectors of the economy are now embracing it. Think of it as like an app store explosion of the Apple App Store explosion of 10 years ago. We've got the tools, we've got the platform. Now let's go out there and make use of it. And that is happening. And that, if it is true and it does manifest itself at the rate that, that we're seeing it happening right now, will sustain this demand for the infrastructure.
Kunjan, I heard you earlier on TV about how you believe NVIDIA deserves the higher multiple that it trades at. Is that because of something like that data center revenue growth and how it's expected to continue?
Absolutely. I mean, right now, the biggest opportunity in semiconductors is AI, right? There's only one player having about 95% or more share. So they have the best revenue growth. Second, margins. When you look at, they're right now have software-like gross margins, something we don't see often in semiconductors. I mean, if just to put in perspective, their next year's operating income is going to be larger than Intel's revenue. I mean, one of the largest semiconductor companies that we know, right? So that tells you they're not just growing, they're growing profitably. And the competitive landscape, as Ian said, right now, there is only one other player. So for the near term, they have the benefit of reaping all the AI spending, which again, is going up across the board.
Well, that's what I wanted to hit on, Kunjan, is total addressable market here. How do you think about that at Bloomberg Intelligence? Like, who's out there that still doesn't have these products, and to what extent are they going to be upgrading products as NVIDIA comes out with new products?
I mean, everyone has the product, but what we are seeing is the total IT CapEx, right, is rising. 2024, from what the cloud customers have announced, they're increasing their total spend by almost 30% at the midpoint. Now, within this spend, the portion of dollars going to AI is increasing exponentially. So you have the pie growing, the portion of AI within the pie growing, and right now, it's all, the only one company monetizing hand over fist is NVIDIA.
Well, okay, so let's go a little bit deeper into competition, Ian. I mean, it's coming. You talk to us about this every time you come on with us. AMD coming out with a rival AI chip. Intel is working on it. NVIDIA's top customers, who are so important in terms of their revenue growth, they're working on things too. I mean, you have a story too today about Intel and Microsoft linking up. And I feel like, you know, frenemies within the tech industry, like people are trying to figure out their way forward. I guess my point, bottom line, is competition, though, is coming here for NVIDIA. But will the market be massive enough that it just doesn't matter, Ian?
That's absolutely a possibility. The other thing to think about as well is from a technical perspective, for 20 years, the whole of the data center industry had every incentive to replace Intel. Intel was charging, you know, an arm and a leg for its server chips. They had every incentive to go out there and replace it, and they couldn't because, guess what? This is difficult. Hmm. Intel fell away from that edge. NVIDIA has replaced it in many respects with a newer technology. Everybody's got every incentive to try and knock them off the pitch, and they will absolutely try. But right now, the pace that this company is moving at, the resources it has, and importantly, how widely it's been deployed already makes it very difficult for anybody to try and replace it with software, with chips, or with, you know, the other infrastructure that goes around it.
Kunjan, help contextualize this moment in the history of technology right now, because I've heard some analysts compare this to, okay, certain like unleashing of the internet, the beginning of the dot-com bubble back in the mid-1990s here, and comparing this to when Americans did get widespread access to the internet and the what we saw built in Silicon Valley after that. How do you think about what's happening with NVIDIA, what's happening with AI in the broader context?
I think I would, the analogy of sort of an iPhone moment would be appropriate. You know, when iPhones and smartphones came up, when you think of adoption and penetration, right? Businesses Earlier, we're thinking, oh, we should have a mobile strategy, right? We should have a mobile vehicle to get to customers. Eventually, if you were a business who did not have a mobile strategy, that would seem insane. So I think that's something what we are seeing here. Right now, Gen AI and AI still is sort of a sexy thing. We would, if this demand does have legs under it, we should see it go to a point where it just becomes the norm on how you do business.
Yeah, I kind of was thinking about that this morning, right? I remember doing a primer. I'm going to date myself. I'm like, what is the internet? But this whole idea, right, before everybody had a mobile site, and we talked about how everybody had to have their own online site. I mean, do you agree, Ian, that's kind of how we need to think about the ramp up in terms of this kind of next level generative machine learning, artificial intelligence, that everybody's going to have some sort of exposure?
I think you have to think about it in a micro way from your own personal life. As a resident of a big city, would you pay $10, $20 a month to never drive your own car in the traffic and to have that taken care of you by a machine? Probably.
Yes.
So, right?
Yeah.
So then you multiply that by all of the mega cities around the world, the Tokyos, the Seouls, the Shanghais, all of those people who live in that kind of city paying $10, $20, semiconductors needed to support those vehicles that are driving themselves, and you've got a big number already, and that's just one sector. And that is the kind of thinking I think that some investors are sort of putting to play when they look at what the potential for this kind of thing is. That's just one area, transport. There are many others, obviously.
All right, real quickly, otherwise my producers are going to kill me, but 5 seconds. First, Kujan, to you. Are we being irrationally exuberant, yes or no, when it comes
no.
to... No. Ian?
Being exuberant, whether it's irrational or not, who can say?
All right. Well done. Well done. I'm not going to get in trouble. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Always appreciate it. Ian King, U.S. Semiconductor and Networking Reporter at Bloomberg News out there in San Francisco. And of course, Kujan Sobhani. He's Senior Semiconductor Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. He's in our San Francisco Bureau.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Another story, in addition to NVIDIA, that we've all been hitting hard here at Bloomberg is the reset in growth and expectations about the ramp up, Tim, when it comes to electric vehicles.
Yeah, on that, and perhaps not as a surprise, as you've been following our coverage closely, EV manufacturers Rivian and Lucid both out with earnings last night and both disappointing. Rivian shares down 26.3% right now. Lucid shares down 14.5%. That's because Rivian issued a disappointing production forecast, announced another round of job cuts. Lucid's production outlook also disappointing, both stocks dropping on the news and dragging down the overall EV sector.
All right, well, covering the space, as always, in depth for us, nonstop, in fact, is Bloomberg News auto reporter Keith Naughton. He joins us in Detroit, Michigan. Keith, good to have you back with both Tim and me. Rivian Lucid, considering the narrative and all the conversations we've had, it shouldn't have come as a surprise.
Well, it did come as a surprise to the street, Carol, as you can see by the stock drop. Yeah. The big surprise was that production forecast of 57,000 vehicles for this year, which is basically flat with last year. The street had been expecting 80,000. So it was a huge miss. And they're cutting back people again. This is the third round of layoffs now for them. There's a question as to whether or not they're going to have enough cash to get to their next round of vehicles, because right now they have very high priced vehicles, and that's one of the big turnoffs for EV buyers.
So Keith, is it more, there's the EV general story, right, that we've been talking about, Tim and I, with you for a while, and then is there also Rivian specific issues here?
Well, they have good vehicles, but where they're positioned in the market right now is the absolute worst location. They're close to the six-figure mark in terms of their pricing, $75,000, $80,000 SUVs and pickup trucks. And, consumers are saying no to prices that high on electric vehicles. Don't mind the convenience issues they're worried about, like charging infrastructure and so forth. That's just a price point that is a bridge too far for consumers.
Keith, we've seen this story play out in the past, and the most recent corollary that comes to mind is Tesla. And there was a time period when Tesla was in production hell, and I remember talking to a family member who is a Tesla owner, and he said, I do love the car. He has a Model 3, but I'm concerned that Tesla's not going to exist as a company in a couple of years. But Tesla, of course, does exist, and although it's down from highs, it's a car company that is, by many measures, successful right now. Can Rivian turn itself around?
It's not clear Rivian can turn itself around. I think that's part of the reason the stock is hitting an all-time low today. I think there is a concern that they won't have enough cash. Will there be a white knight who will come along to get them if that's the case? I don't think worrying about Tesla's future, though, is a good bet. Tesla is the only company out there actually making money selling EVs, even with all their price cuts. Sure, their margins have shrunk, but they still make a profit selling electric vehicles, and they still dominate the EV market in the U.S. And while BYD has surpassed them globally, they're still right up there. So I think the Tesla story will continue. It's the question of everyone else.
When you talk about a white knight or potential white knight for Rivian, is this possibly another automaker? I know we're just kind of speculating here. Or would it be somebody who actually invests, whether it's private equity money or some other sort of money, investment money?
Yeah, this is total speculation. But the auto companies are hemorrhaging cash on their own EV operations. You saw Ford is saying they're going to lose more than $5 billion on their EV operations this year, and they lost almost that much last year. Mercedes is dialing back its EV plans. Everyone is dialing back their EV production plans and trying to scale back their spending. So there's not a lot of free cash flow lying around at automakers, the legacy automakers, for M&A. So you'd have to wonder, is there a tech firm out there? Is there somebody else with deep pockets that doesn't have this call on cash that the legacy automakers do?
When Elon Musk and Tesla were facing challenges, Keith, Elon talked a lot about U.S. car companies that hadn't succeeded over the last 50 years. You've been covering automakers in Detroit for a long time. Why is this so difficult?
Such a profound technological transformation. For example, when the Japanese came in the 1980s, what they did is they perfected something that already existed. They took internal combustion engine cars, they made them with higher quality and more reliability, and they made them more efficiently. So that attracted consumers. But we're talking about a complete transformation in the technology now, a new, system to propel the car down the road. And the legacy automakers are not the experts in this area. Tesla is, BYD is. The Chinese EVs are outstanding. They're not in the United States yet, but they're coming.
All right. We haven't touched on too much Lucid. So what's the Lucid story? That stock's down at its lows today, down 22%. Right now, down about 14%. It's a $3 stock here. What's the constructive conversation around Lucid for you?
Yeah. So Lucid is an even higher price point, deeply into the luxury territory. And my goodness, they're saying they're going to build 9,000 vehicles this year. Just a few years ago, they thought they'd be building 90,000 vehicles by now. There just hasn't been the market developing for that high-end vehicle. It's a smaller company. It's not as well capitalized. So, you know, that's an even tougher road.
Keith, how does this shake out? Does it shake out in the sense that, okay, you know, looking into the crystal ball, we see a handful of legacy automakers like Ford and GM, and perhaps some of the Japanese automakers with their hybrid models in the next few years successfully selling these, and the upstarts that we've been talking about over the past few years perhaps not actually succeeding?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely going to be a shakeout, and there will be companies that don't succeed. I think we're already seeing that. But even with the legacy automakers, they're not all going to succeed either. You saw Carlos Tavares, the CEO of Stellantis, said the other day he thinks about 5 legacy automakers will make it through. So, you know, it's a tough, disruptive moment in the industry, and everybody is still trying to figure out, you know, how to perfect the electric vehicle, and very few have a winning strategy so far.
Let's dig into the Tavares comments for a second. I mean, from your perspective, from the analysts you speak to, which legacy automakers could be at risk of not making it?
Well, I mean, you know, the mainstream players who don't have the margins that the luxury players have, you know, that's tougher. There was this thought that, you know, the early movers are the most likely to survive. But, you know, maybe those who kept their powder dry and haven't, you know, hemorrhaged cash on EV operations will be in a healthier place once the EV market takes off. So it's kind of hard to tell right now what the winning play is. It seemed clearer a couple of years ago when everybody thought the EV market would just take off like a rocket. But now that, you know, we're still kind of stuck on the launching pad, it's harder to know what the right play is.
It also makes me wonder, Keith, that, okay, wait a minute, we've been saying we need more charging stations, we need more infrastructure to support it. Now I feel like that's going to slow down dramatically, and that's just going to slow down the adoption even more so. Is that, I don't know, the smart way or the right way to think about it? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you can come up with a bunch of death spiral scenarios, if you will, Carol. The hope is that when we get to the second generation of electric vehicles, even with Tesla and Rivian in particular, that the costs will come down and therefore the prices will come down. And then you finally reach this tipping point of adoption. But we're not there yet, and we haven't really seen those vehicles yet. So we don't know what promise they hold. What we do know is that the Chinese EVs are really perfecting it, and they have very attractive vehicles and very low cost points. BYD has an $11,000 electric vehicle called the Seagull. So if those make it into the U.S. market, that's really going to change the dynamics of this market.
How is BYD able to do this at such a lower price point?
Well, they have, you know, very low cost labor in China. Let's start with that.
Does Tesla at the Shanghai plant.
They do, but Tesla also makes them in Texas and in California. Yeah. So and in Europe, where there isn't low cost labor. And they have a government that has supported them. I mean, you know, it's a government that has directed this. They're trying to become, you know, globally dominant in electric vehicles, and they're off to a good start.
Interesting. All right. Well, certainly a couple of stories that certainly, as we said, play into kind of the broader conversation that we've been having about the EV space, but pretty remarkable. Keith, thank you as always. Keith Naughton, he is Bloomberg News auto reporter, joining us out there in Detroit, Michigan.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We did get a batch of economic news earlier today. Be sure to head to Bloomberg.com and get all the details. But one report that we wanted to check out was what happened with sales of previously owned U.S. homes, rising in January by the most in nearly a year. Buyers taking advantage of lower mortgage rates at the start of the new year of 2024.
Okay, at the start of the year. Because right. Just yesterday, we reported how U.S. mortgage rates jumped above 7% for the first time since early December. That dealt a blow to the housing market's nascent recovery. So the rates issue is certainly sticking with us.
Yeah, so let's get to it and what it all means. Kate Kaminsky is chief operating officer of the privately owned and asset and real estate investment company. It is Walton Global. They've got about $3.6 billion in assets and over 94,000 acres under management here in the United States. She joins us, Kate does, from Scottsdale, Arizona. Kate, welcome to Bloomberg Business Week. Nice to have you here with Tim and me. How are you? And talk to us about your world, because you guys do commercial, industrial, residential, real estate. Give us kind of an overview of how things are going. Better than the last year, better than the last 6 months? What can you tell us?
Yeah, we're pretty excited about 2024 here at Walton. We really focus on the land space. We're buying land in the path of growth, predominantly to sell to public new home builders. But we also, as you noted, have industrial, commercial, and retail holdings. So the numbers that came out today, you know, really important in terms of what we're seeing in the resale market, which has a direct impact on the new home building space, which is where we focus. With the resale figures seeing, the slowest year for the last three decades in 2023, we're excited that January was finally an uptick in terms of the resale market. And you know, that continued increase in value. I think we were at about 5% in increase in existing home sale value year over year. So strong numbers on the resale market, but you know, still seeing a continued push for buyers to that new home market because of a lot of the lock-in effect that we're seeing from those mortgage rates, which, as you noted, are creeping up a bit.
Hey, Kate, how would you characterize demand from the home builders right now? Because you guys have property all over the United States. You've got a lot in Colorado, a lot in California, Oklahoma, Texas, Florida, Georgia. How would you characterize the demand that you're seeing from home builders who want to buy that land and then build homes on it?
I mean, home builder sentiment is up. I think it was at 44 percent. We're seeing more transactions go under contract right now than we did certainly a year ago, which 2023 was a good year here at Walton. We've got around $2.8 billion in deal volume that's at various stages, hoping to move that towards closing. So we're still seeing a lot of demand, but certainly builders are looking to take positions right now. Permits are up just across the board. We've seen a year of month over month increases. And I think right now we're sitting at just over a million units at an annualized rate, which is up 35% year over year. So, you know, permits showing us what we can expect for the future, what our forecasts are looking like.
What's land prices look like right now?
So, you know, like everything else, we continue to see that increase, but it's remaining somewhat consistent. And where we're really seeing a lot of our negotiations take place is working with builders on understanding what development costs are going to be, timelines, and working to ensure that everyone's margins are really remaining consistent and hitting those targets that they're looking for.
But for you, for the acquisition costs, are land prices going up? And I'm curious if there's, I'm assuming there are geographical differences. I mean, I know I've got a lot of family down south and it's kind of on fire right now. So if you can give us some context as you look across the United States, where you're seeing land values go up a lot, because that's your bread and butter, right?
Yeah, our assets are really focused in the southern half of the United States. If I were to pull our acquisitions team or talk to any of the builders, I mean, land prices are going up right across the board, and it's getting more and more difficult to find any deals. I would say they're few and far between right now. The markets that we're really focusing on continue to be Florida, Texas, Georgia, and the Carolinas, and then, you know, of course, in the Southwest and West as well. But definitely seeing increases in land values, and a lot of that has to do with the lack of supply of development ready land. We continue to see significant challenges right across the country as it pertains to land getting approved for development. This is a challenge that builders and landowners are facing across the board as we have more municipalities really restricting especially that high density residential development, which is where this country quite frankly needs more supply in those lower price sectors.
Yeah, we could do an entire interview just based on the yeah. politics and the policy here. But Kate, help our audience understand, our viewers and our listeners understand the role that you play as sort of a middle person in this market, because perhaps some of them are asking themselves, well, why doesn't the landowner go directly to the developer and actually make more money when they sell that? What's the value that you bring to the transaction by holding onto the land from the landowner to the developer?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And our entire business is really focused right now on feeding builders, you know, demand for just-in-time inventory. Just-in-time inventory is as simple as, you know, builders post Great Recession, we're penalized significantly for holding long-term land assets that were not income generating, that they weren't going to turn in, call it a two-year time frame. So Walton comes in, we buy these land assets and we sell them to builders, typically, you know, on a phase-by-phase basis over time, as they're ready to take it down and start development and ultimately build a home. And so we're kind of in that land banking space, right. For those of you familiar with the term, which is something that we're seeing right across the board. Every builder is really being forced to utilize that tool in their toolbox.
Right, so it's not kind of stuck on their balance sheet, especially if there's any kind of downturn. Kate, got 30 seconds left here. In terms of what you are seeing, are you setting up for a U.S. economy that's recovering, that's growing, that might have a recession? And just real quickly, 25 seconds if you could.
Definitely looking at growth. I mean, if you just look at the population numbers from last year alone, I think it was the largest one-year population increase in history. That plus, you know, the builders continuing to buy down rates for new home buyers, I think we're going to see really strong figures in the balance of this year and in the economy in general.
All right, going to leave it on that note. Kate, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Kate Kaminsky, Chief Operating Officer of the privately owned asset and real estate investment company Walton Global, joining us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Home builders as a group, they're up about 1.5% here in 2024. And we're seeing, yeah, them up a little bit higher as well today. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, Twitter's board once seriously considered then AWS head and now Amazon CEO Andy Jassy to be CEO of the company. Dorsey was this close, or Disney, excuse me, was this close to buying the company, albeit it was a lowball offer. And Jack Dorsey, the co-founder and former CEO of Twitter, Carol, begins each morning with three things: salt juice, sunshine, and movement. Sounds pretty nice, right?
Everything around this is interesting. All right, these are just a few of the tidbits in the battle for the bird. Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. The brand new book from Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagner, who has been everywhere, and rightfully so. So great to see it getting so much coverage. The book did come out on Tuesday. It's a great read. Everyone is indeed talking about it. Kurt joining us right now from Denver. Kurt, first of all, let's talk about, as you are making the rounds, what kind of feedback are you getting? What are people saying? I am curious if X or Twitter is called. Like, what are you hearing? What is the feedback?
Yeah, it's been really fun. I mean, this is a great week for me personally. It's been a lot of fun to like see this out in the world. But I think, you know, Twitter's a company, as you both know, that has just been covered so closely for such a long time. So one thing I was really worried about when writing this book was like, is there going to be new stuff here, right? Are people just going to feel like they're reading stories that they've already read years ago or months ago? And I've been really pleasantly surprised. A lot of the fun details, you know, some of the things that Tim just even mentioned, right, are starting to bubble up. And I think people are realizing, hey, you know, we knew some of the story as these things were unfolding live, but you know, the book is obviously providing a lot more color than we were able to do at the time. And it's just been really fun for me to sort of see those little details really land with people who thought they knew Twitter before they started reading.
Anything yet from Elon at this point, Kurt?
No, nothing from Elon. I mentioned in the book, I tried to get both Elon and Jack Dorsey to speak for the book. Neither of them did. Maybe it'll happen at some point. I'm not really holding my breath right now, but you know, nothing so far from Elon.
Okay, well, let's go to Jack Dorsey because he's a big focus of your book. And I want to talk a little bit about his philosophy around Twitter as a utility and less as a business. Because for a long time, I think, you know, when it was a public company, people were thinking to themselves, wait a second, does this thing actually work as a for-profit company, or should this be more of a tool? Should it be truly like a utility that people have access to?
Yeah, this was something that Jack Dorsey thought about a lot. And, you know, obviously he ran the company while it was a publicly traded company. He was a co-founder, you know, and early CEO when they ultimately decided to set it up the way that they did. But I think in a perfect world for him, you know, Twitter would have been a public good, a public service of some kind where you're not worried about appeasing advertisers, you're not worried about appeasing investors, you're just simply giving people a place to talk, right? But unfortunately, once it is a publicly traded company, it's really hard to go backwards and kind of change how the company is set up. And even though he sort of talked about this with the board over time, you know, his one way thinking that Twitter could do this was to sell to Elon Musk. And you're right, I spent a lot of time in the book kind of highlighting that relationship between those two guys, because Jack saw Elon and bringing Twitter private as a way to sort of fulfill this idea that, you know, it wouldn't be tied to a business for the long term, which he always sort of regretted.
Gotta love the chapters. A couple involving Mr. Trump, the former president. There's also one I cannot say because we are a family network. But what was the thing, I don't know, as you go through this process, it's such an incredible tale. It's something that I still like. I think most of us still do as it kind of reinvents itself.
Depends on if I click the For You tab or the following.
Depends on the day.
Right.
But what was the most remarkable thing in this kind of journalistic journey for you?
Yeah, I mean, there was a bunch of things, but there was a moment sort of like when right before Elon showed up as Twitter's largest shareholder, when I learned that he had been pestering then CEO Parag Agrawal to remove the ElonJet account, right? Mm-hmm. So you probably both know the ElonJet account. It tracks his plane, and it's gotten in some hot water for tracking Taylor Swift's plane. But Elon hated that this account existed on Twitter. He hated that it was tracking his private plane. And so he petitioned the company to remove it. They didn't remove it. And very shortly after that, he starts buying a stake in the company, right? And I can't say for certain that that's why he ultimately, you know, bought Twitter, but it kind of feels like the timing is interesting. And there's a bunch of little moments like that that sort of lead up to this acquisition, right? I think from the outside, it looked like he just showed up one day, you know, out of the blue, right? But I think what the book tries to do is explain that there were things happening behind the scenes we didn't know about that led us to that moment. And that was just one of a handful that are included in the book.
Okay, so help us look forward, Kurt, and understand what the future of Twitter looks like under Elon Musk and what you learned about his ambitions for it.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard him talk about this idea that X is going to be something totally different, right? They're really working hard to distance themselves from the prior Twitter group. And he's, you know, he's talked about building an everything app, right? You would use it for banking. You would use it to make payments. Obviously, video is something they're pushing really heavily into. I'm pretty, you know, I'm not necessarily optimistic that this is going to work, in part because I feel like what Twitter was great at was one thing, which was news, right? That was sort of Twitter's superpower. It was the place to go for news. It was not the place you went to pay your friends. It was not the place you went to make purchases. And that's what he's trying to do. So he's really trying to pivot this entire company to something completely different. And I suppose you could say, well, you know, you admire the effort. I'm just a little bit of a skeptical that he's going to be able to ultimately pull that off.
Well, incredible stuff as always. Kurt, every time we talk with you about it, we want more. So you got to promise you're going to come back and we'll continue this. It's called Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. The brand new book from Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.